Hi, everyone. We're off this week, but I wanted to pull one of my favorite old episodes out of the archives. Enjoy. Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
So much of Watergate, I can't tell you, was just pure blunder and stupidity. And we're seeing the same thing happen again.
Today's guest, John Dean, the former Nixon White House counsel who was involved in Watergate, turned into a witness, went to jail, and has since reinvented himself as an investment banker and author living in Los Angeles. Investigations have obviously been a big part of the first year of the Trump presidency, starting from almost day one. What did the Russians do? What role did Trump campaign officials play? Who knew what? When? What was Paul Manafort up to? Why did Michael Flynn lie to the FBI? How much was President Trump himself involved? Why did he really fire Comey? What else is going on? Or is this all just a case of mess-ups, coincidences, bad luck, and fueled by sour grapes over losing an election? Or is it conspiracy, collusion, cover-up? Not a lot of people have lived through what people in the White House are living through as this investigation continues. And by the way, we're talking about a House investigation and a Senate investigation on top of the special counsel investigation by Bob Mueller. But John Dean has. He was the lawyer asked to get involved in the Watergate cover-up from the outset, then asked by Nixon to prepare a report on what happened until he flipped and started cooperating with the investigators. And he did it while he was still working in the White House. So he went to jail and he's been writing about what happened and obviously thinking about it ever since. Obviously, his view of whatever's going on with the investigation into the Trump campaign and White House is from the outside. But his sense of what people there are going through from his own experiences is one I'm really glad he was willing to share. Even though we couldn't catch up in person, we did it over the phone. And now, my conversation with John Dean. So let's start with stepping back for a moment. You have this perspective, which is different from almost anybody on the planet. Is it difficult to realize a bigger crisis taking shape when you're in the middle of it? I mean, when we think about Watergate now, it's always in retrospect, people think about, and they can sort of put the pieces together in reverse with 2020 hindsight. What did it seem like as it was going on? And of course, I'm looking for the comparison here to the extent that you see any to what's going on in the current moment.
When you're in the bunker, you do catch the incoming fire and see it coming. But you think you can weather it. It was a long time. Watergate, as you recall, or maybe you wouldn't recall, but it ran 928 days from the event that gave the scandal its name, the arrest at the Democratic National Committee, to the last of the trials of Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Mitchell being convicted on January 1 of 75. A little bit after that, before, it wasn't until October that the Watergate prosecutor's office closed down, but that was primarily Campaign Act violations they were looking at then.
Right.
So it was a long run. We're pretty early right now. I know that there's a lot of thought in the White House, apparently, by Ty Cobb, their counsel handling this, that this somehow is going to wrap up here at the end of the year or early next year. I think that's wishful thinking.
He had originally predicted that it would be done by Thanksgiving. Obviously, that's not true. So I'm not sure his predictive powers on this hold up. You're obviously seeing it from the outside the way that most of us are. What do you see when you look at what's happening with the Trump folks? And again, from the perspective of somebody who's been through this, obviously.
Well, it's really how remarkable that little they've learned about what went on in the past. Every signal they've thrown from the get-go has been, we're covering this up. They've done nothing to try to really dispose of it. While Ty Cobb says he's cooperating with the prosecutors, turning over documents and witnesses and what have you, well, those witnesses should have all been marched down there to the grand jury and said, we got nothing to hide.
Right.
You know, if you look at the Obama presidency, which was scandal-free, also without drama, they nipped these things in the bud. They were open. They were transparent before anything could get really afoot. Even when the Republicans were doing their best to invent scandals with things like Benghazi and what have you. So, you know, the whole attitude has been, we're hiding something. And so I can only conclude they are hiding something. I don't know what it is. I don't know if they colluded or not. Collusion itself is not a crime. Conspiracy is a crime. And whether they've done that or not, I don't know. I've always suspected it's something to do with Trump's money. And when his credit went bad, that he somehow relied on Russian funding or Russian credit. And that would be very embarrassing to him.
We've reported that people in the White House are getting paranoid, that other people are cooperating. Maybe people are wearing wires. Do you remember when that sense of paranoia set in?
The Nixon White House was built on a need-to-know basis. Not a lot of cross-fertilization of thinking and activities. Everything was highly compartmentalized. So when Watergate happened, it wasn't particularly unique that it was highly compartmentalized. The paranoia was pretty much there all along. And that obviously was some of the cause for some of the problems. I think the Trump administration they've in a very similar fashion came in knowing that the bureaucracy was against them. Nixon claimed he had a secret plan to end the war. He had no such plan. In fact, when he started escalating it, his National Security Council turned on him. He had a terrific problem with leaks. I tweeted long before Trump arrived that he was going to be plagued by leaks. I mean, it was quite evident. I mean, his attacks on the intelligence agencies,
right.
Not smart, just asking for trouble. He seems to think that his sheer will of personality can hush people or get them to do what they want, whether it be the UN approve his move of an embassy to having everybody just do as he thinks they should do. The government doesn't work that way. This isn't private business, not the private sector. And he can't choose who he can work with and who he can't. The government has a process that he's got to deal with. So I'm sure that they've been paranoid all along. The fact that Papadopoulos was wearing a wire, I'm sure, caught some of them by surprise. And I'm sure they all know who he talked to and when in the post-election time frame. So they probably figured out what they did talk about when he might have been wired. But I suspect Mueller just wanted a couple points buttoned up. And how productive that'll be, we'll have to all wait and see.
There are people, Papadopoulos is cooperating. We know Michael Flynn is now cooperating. From your own experience, can you talk through what that decision is like to get to the point where you feel like, okay, I'm going to cooperate with the investigators? And then when you did it, as I said, you and people probably know, you did not make that known to other people in the White House right away. And you know, what that's like showing up to work, knowing that you're in a different place than people realize that you are.
Well, I kind of went through my analysis post Watergate. I fell into three phases. The initial phase was I didn't have any responsibility for what they'd done, but I thought I could help them out. I knew they were in a lot of trouble. And so I could communicate with the other lawyers and learn what was going on. I didn't foresee anybody getting in criminal trouble. And the part of that was ignorance of the criminal law. It never occurred to me you needed to be a criminal defense lawyer to work as White House counsel. It was essential in the Nixon White House. You'd be a highly trained one. But all White House counsel since Watergate have had somebody with a criminal law background. I didn't have that. I wish I had. So initially I got in it not thinking I was going to get in any trouble. I don't realize I'm in trouble. Excuse me. I don't realize I'm in trouble until after the election, when Chuck Colson, who was Nixon's special counsel and better known as a hatchet man, brought me a recording of a conversation he'd had with Howard Hunt, who was one of the co-managers of the Watergate break-in with Gordon Liddy. And Colson was delighted to come down and play this recording for me of his phone call post-election with Hunt, that it showed through leading questions he got Hunt to admit he had nothing to do with the Watergate break-in.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something much more important I heard on the tape, and that was that Hunt was complaining that he wasn't being paid fast enough, and
right.
And if he wasn't paid soon, this whole thing was going to fall apart. In other words, I heard quid pro quo for the first time, and I knew we were in trouble.
Yeah.
All right. What was interesting, though, and I didn't understand for years, my reaction, I doubled down. That's when I decided this cover-up has to work. That's when I did dumb things like destroy documents that related to Hunt's activities with Ehrlichman on the so-called break-in into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office,
mm-hmm.
which was the reason that the Watergate, which had used the same people, became an issue for the White House. Because I've never seen any evidence that the Nixon White House ordered the Watergate break-in. Yeah, they knew that they had that capacity, but they didn't set it up, and they could have avoided criminal responsibility for it. But anyway, I doubled down for a while, and then what happens is Hunt sends a message to Ehrlichman through me, through the lawyers at the reelection committee, that if he isn't paid $120,000 yesterday, he's going to have seamy things to say about what he did for John Ehrlichman. And this is an obvious reference to the Ellsberg break-in that he'd done while working at the White House. And it was just one of those hit me. It was on March 19th of 1973. I had really just started dealing with the president. The president didn't call me until 8 months after the arrests at the Watergate. I had really no dealings with him at all, because he wanted Haldeman and Ehrlichman working on new personnel and new policy for his second term, and he knew that I was reporting to them, and they in turn reporting to him, he just decided to cut them out and deal directly with me. And so by then, I thought he had some confidence in me, and I thought, when I got that message from Hunt, I said, this is going to go on forever. We're being extorted. It is never going to end. It is never going to end well. There's only one person who can end it, and that's Richard Nixon.
And you get kind of caught up in the moment, right? And doing and fixing now new problems, but those cause additional problems.
Exactly. So I, on March 21st, went in and told him he had a cancer on his presidency. And it was the Watergate cover-up, and tried to get him to bring his fist down on the desk and say, this has got to end. Well, I think that's the first morning I really met Richard Nixon. I found out what he was made of, and covering up Watergate, I didn't know at that time how deeply involved he was. I do today, because a couple of years ago, in 2014, I did a book where I transcribed all of Nixon's Watergate conversations, about 1,000 of them. And he was, by the time I got to him, he had been involved in every key decision.
What were the conversations, like the interpersonal conversations you were having with your colleagues when you tell them this, okay, well, I flipped, you should all flip. Are they mad at you? Are they scared of you? Do they stop talking? What happens then? Because, I feel like
maybe,
this is, yeah.
they continued talking with me. Ehrlichman suggesting that only Nixon could give me clemency to end this whole thing for me with a happy ending, trying to, in essence, bribe me to silence, which wasn't smart. They compounded their problems. They didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know how much I knew. I knew much more than they thought I did. Not that I was involved in it, but just I had picked it up over the years of being there. And so I became their worst nightmare. I was determined to end it once and for all and just clean the whole thing up. When I did finally testify, with Flynn and his proximity, he even had more proximity than did I. He could be a remarkable witness.
Yeah.
And
he was the national security advisor, right?
Exactly. And he'd be smart to, I'll tell you one thing. He will be severely attacked. He will be attacked, not only by the White House, but by all of Trump's surrogates. But, you know, if he's telling the truth, in the end, he'll be on the right side. It's a rough road. It's not a pleasant experience.
Yeah, what is that experience? What do you? Obviously, there are a lot of particulars to Michael Flynn that are different from your particulars. But when you're a guy sitting there meeting with investigators, prosecutors in this kind of situation, obviously with this spotlight of national politics and the White House and all this stuff mixed up in it, what do you think he's going through? What's Michael Flynn's day-to-day experience with this, both in those meetings and then when you leave those meetings and go home? What do you think it's like for him?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. He obviously knows he lied to the FBI. He obviously knew that was a criminal act. He's not stupid. He's the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency.
And well-respected guy.
And it had to be, when he finally decided to plead, relief. He is not a thug. He's not a criminal. This isn't the way of life that he wants to lead. So getting it behind him has had to have been a cleansing experience. It's just not pleasant to operate in these dark circles if you have any conscience at all. I don't happen to think that Donald Trump has a conscience. I think he is, I think he is so self-absorbed and everything is so about him. He seems shameless. He does. He just isn't troubled by these sort of things. So I don't think it would bother him, but I don't sense Flynn is of that nature.
And Flynn, I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since he pled, and in that time, presumably he's kept meeting with the investigators. And what about that? I mean, beyond the sense of relief of actually just pleading, then going forward from there, when you are cooperating, when you're having more conversations, and when you go home after having those conversations, what's that like?
Well, I'm sure it's all very friendly. He's a cooperating witness. I assume he'll be a good witness. I had a rather, when I was testifying, it was pre-computer era. Mm-hmm. While there were computers that were about the size of of an automobile, they didn't have laptops.
Right.
And I had knowledge and memory, because that's where I was used, particularly during the trial of the special prosecutor, Jim Neal, the lead trial lawyer. Just even during the trial, after I testified, had me in the back room of the courthouse so he could come back and get facts from me. He said, there's just so darn much information to remember. He wanted somebody right there who he could sort of.
That's when you were known as the human tape recorder, right?
Well, Jill Vollner, who was an assistant prosecutor, she's now, the analogy she uses is I was like a laptop.
Mm-hmm. But so well, is
anyway,
it?
Anyway, I suspect that Flynn knows all the facts and knows who did what and where, and you know, even if he is pardoned out of Trump saying it's just a pure matter of compassion, this man has been a great soldier and what have you, and I'm going to let him off. I don't think that doesn't end his testimonial responsibilities. In fact, to the contrary, he can be indicted again,
right,
for perjury.
You spent a lot of time and a lot of intense moments, I guess I should say, with Nixon. You have your view of Trump. One of the things that seems to maybe differentiate them, at least in the common perception of how both of them approach this, is that Nixon seemed to know what he was doing. He seemed to understand it. And part of the defense that has come up about Trump, about firing Comey and some of the other things, is that he maybe didn't realize, it's not obstruction of justice if he doesn't realize he's trying to get an investigation shut down, is basically the argument. That if he says, hey, I hope you're loyal to me, what he was trying to say is, yeah, like, loyalty is important to me, not please stop investigating Michael Flynn, and I'm telling you that as the president to the FBI director. Does that seem...
Ignorance of the law is really no excuse in our system. I can tell you that everybody who got involved in the obstruction of justice at the Nixon White House didn't have a clue what obstruction of justice was, including me. I later, after I read the statute and telling Haldeman and Ehrlichman, as well as Nixon, it's on the tapes, it's clear Nixon didn't know anything about obstruction of justice.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to Watergate, very, very few prosecutors or lawyers knew about obstruction of justice. Watergate put obstruction on the map as a high profile crime, if you will. So, you know, what Trump is doing and has done is so much of Watergate, I can't tell you, was just pure blunder and stupidity. And we're seeing the same thing happen again.
Right. There's the line from All the President's Men. The truth is these guys were not very smart, or whatever it is, you know, and they got in over their heads and something like that. That seems to you a fair assessment of what happened then, it seems like, right?
That I think you can draw a direct line between the two, that they didn't go in there with an evil motive to run the place like, you know, the Godfather, but just pure stupidity results in a lot of dumb actions. And I think that's what he was, you know, he wanted a loyal FBI director. So he said, well, I want you to be loyal to me.
Yeah.
Comey read that for what it was. Can't you give him a break? You know, just us two guys talking about this. Well, that isn't the guy you want to talk to about it. The head of the FBI and a former deputy attorney general, a former federal prosecutor, who's got an official responsibility. And Trump, you know, I don't recall Nixon ever using the stupidity defense, or Haldeman or Ehrlichman, believe it or not. They just kind of tried to bluster through that they didn't have a criminal intent. Unfortunately, motive and intent in the law are different. What they thought, because what they were doing was purely political and trying to minimize the impact of this blundered break-in at the Watergate, that they thought because their motive was just political, they had no criminal intent.
Right.
Well, they intended to do the actions they did, which was stop the investigation. That's what Trump did. His motive is irrelevant.
And this idea from his lawyer that the president, that we heard a couple weeks ago, the president cannot obstruct justice was one of the arguments because he is the chief law enforcement officer. That struck a lot of people first.
That is absurd. Nixon, if you look at Article 1 of the impeachment bill of impeachment against Nixon, it is all about obstruction of justice. It is true that under existing policy, which is controlling for Mueller, he can't indict Trump at the moment unless he files an action to reverse the policy of the Department of Justice. And that policy started in 1973 when Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, said, "I can't be indicted, I can only be impeached." And the Office of Legal Counsel issued an opinion saying, "No, Mr. Vice President, you can be indicted. It's the president who can't be indicted." And that opinion was reissued in 2000. So that's been the standing policy of the Department of Justice. A lot of lawyers, both at the Watergate Special Prosecution Office and others along the way, have think that opinion is baseless, that nobody in our system is above the law. And the argument that hangs on the fact that the president is the head of an entire branch of government is cured by the 25th Amendment, where the vice president can come in and temporarily take charge while the president is dealing with, say, an indictment in a trial, criminal trial.
Overall, the comparisons between Trump and Nixon, what are they similar people in your mind? Are they, how do you see them stack up next to each other?
I think they're similar and different in this regard. Behind closed doors, Nixon is very much an authoritarian personality. In public, he's too shy to be authoritarian. They're both authoritarian personalities. Trump is very out front in his authoritarianism. In fact, that's part of the reason a lot of people voted for him. People like this Nixon's strength, but he, as I say, was not as dictatorial as, say, Trump is in public. He did that. He ranted and raved behind closed doors with his tape machine going. So they're similar in that regard. Their huge difference is the level of sophistication of Nixon versus Trump. Trump really doesn't know anything about how government operates. He doesn't even seem to have a very good newspaper knowledge of it. He's getting on-the-job training on the job that doesn't really work with on-the-job training. Every president has a lot to learn. But I don't think he had any idea how Washington really worked.
No. Or how the presidency worked.
And so it's been a rude awakening for him. And it takes more than it can take 4 years to learn how that place really operates. I think he's a little bit more frightening. Nixon did understand how the presidency worked and used it. Trump isn't likely to be found guilty of the same abuses of power that Nixon was, because he doesn't know he has the power to pick up the phone and tell the Secretary of Treasury to start auditing Bob Mueller's tax returns. He hasn't thought that through yet. Nixon had.
Do you think if Watergate happened today in the current political climate, do you think... if everything else is the same, essentially, does Nixon feel compelled to leave office, do you think?
I think the big difference is the media coverage. First of all, the social media, there's the internet, the news cycles are faster. I think Watergate would have occurred at a much more accelerated speed than the 928 days it took to go from the arrest at the Watergate to the conviction of Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Mitchell et al. So I think that's one factor. I think I think there's more likelihood he might have survived if there had been a Fox News. I've never seen anything like the display that's happened in the last 20 or so days with Republicans undercutting the special counsel. The show that the Republicans put on in front of the House Judiciary Committee attacking the Deputy Attorney General of their own party is just unprecedented. You know, what occurred to me, and then hearing these news accounts of the small group of rogue Republicans who are planning on how to bring charges of some sort against the FBI and the Department of Justice, some sort of criminal charges. These are people from the Intelligence Committee who are apparently using information that they're getting from the committee, but yet it's not as a part of the committee's action.
Right.
This is the Devin Nunes.
First reported by Politico, we should say.
Exactly. Well, you know what's interesting is that caused me to pull out the case law on the speech and debate clause of the Constitution in Article 1, which immunizes legislative activities by members of Congress. There's, you know, they cannot commit crimes up there with impunity if they are not acting in a legislative manner. Well, I'm not sure that Nunes and a couple other guys trying to cook up something to feather the bed for Trump to fire Comey or whatever the hell they're doing could not be an obstruction of justice. Those statutes are very broad. Members of Congress in both the House and Senate have tried to use the debate clause, speech and debate clause, to protect themselves from everything from bribery to taking care of constituents with the executive branch, and been shown that clause is not that broad. And there's clearly, when they're engaging in non-legislative activity, and this appears to not be regular order. It's not taking place through the committee. And I think they're on dangerous ground. And somebody, I don't know if their colleagues are able to pull them up short or what. If the House changes hands in 2018 and 2019, the Democrats might go after them for what they're doing.
That's not, I hadn't heard that point from Reyes. It's interesting. And certainly, if the House changes hands, I think the Democrats are going to be looking for a lot of different ways to exert their new control and the power of it. Do you see impeachable offenses yet, do you think, from what your perspective of it? You're talking about pulling out the rules about the House members. Or does it concern you that we throw around the word impeachment now as such a like easy political thing when you don't like what happens?
You could impeach a president for being incompetent without committing a crime. What's been argued by anybody who's been subject to impeachment, this runs from presidents to judges to anybody, any officer of the government, they've always claimed that it has to be criminal activity. It really, there's no such standard. It's high crimes and misdemeanors, as well as bribery and what have you. And these are very vague terms. Has Trump committed an impeachable offense? Maybe being unprepared to be president is one. That's not likely to be. Obstruction of justice is certainly, because the Republicans went after Clinton for obstruction of justice based on his misstatement or lying to a grand jury. And that is a form of obstruction under the federal criminal law, also under the case law.
And just for the people other than Trump who might be mixed up in this, and again, to call in your perspective on this, does the possibility of a pardon change the thinking, or do you think, I mean, like that must have been something that played into your mind. Is there a pardon out there for me, or how does that work, or how do I?
I never thought Nixon would pardon me. I thought he might. I thought he might pardon Haldeman and Ehrlichman. I realize now that he figured it out before it was all over, that they had misled him to a high degree. So much of he learned about Watergate happens 8 months after the fact, when he starts dealing with me and I'm telling him things about why the White House is in the middle of this. Is because of the Ellsberg break-in.
Yeah,
he doesn't know that before I start telling him these things. So they withheld an awful lot of information from him, and I think he was angry at the end, and he just said, "I'm not going to pardon anybody." George Bush won, of course, used the pardon pretty effectively to make sure that Iran-Contra didn't come after him when there could have been some problems for him. They were fairly tangential, but they could have been a nightmare. And so he cleaned it up. Bush, too, didn't have any hesitation of pardoning or commuting Scooter Libby's sentence.
Right.
So he wouldn't have to go to jail. Post Watergate, the use of the pardon to take care of cronies has become more common.
Let's just finish. I want to read you a quote from one of your books, "Conservatives Without Conscience." It's always, as a writer myself, to be quoted back to yourself is a good way to end, I guess. You wrote this book. It came out in 2006. And you were talking about the rise of authoritarian conservatism. And you wrote, "Authoritarianism has become the dominant reality of conservative thought. In the past four decades, with varying degrees of proximity, I've watched with dismay as conservatism has fallen into its present state of cluttered ideas and beliefs. It has become a potpourri of political philosophies that embrace any number of often incompatible thoughts." So that's 12 years ago. That's before anybody was ever thinking about Donald Trump or the current political moment. Do you stand by that? How does that hold up to you in this moment?
I would not only stand by it, I'd say it was fairly prescient. It's pretty descriptive. I was baffled as to what had happened to conservatism, and when I wrote that book, you're correct. I wrote it in 2005,
right,
and it was published in 2006. And the deeper I got into particularly movement conservatism, I discovered, how dominant the authoritarian personalities were. There are two types of authoritarian personalities. One are what are the social scientists call social dominators. They're the leaders. Trump is clearly a social dominator. That's just a small number of the authoritarian population. The far larger are just people who are authoritarian followers. They want to be told how to think, what to do, that daddy, if you will take care of them and watch after the world for them. These are people who are fairly thoughtless. There are a couple pages in there where I took all the social science available and prepared lists of the personality traits of these people, not based on what social scientists say about them, but what they say about themselves through social science testing them. These are the people who have now come forward and taken charge of the government. I'm actually playing with the idea, since I wrote that book in 2006, finished it, of picking up where, a lot has happened in the last 11 years, everything from the Tea Party to Donald Trump. And, you know, the thrust and direction. I wrote that book hoping that by tipping people off to what was going on, it might prevent it from happening. Well, it didn't. And it's only gotten worse. Incidentally, the book has had striking sales activity since Trump arrived.
Well, so maybe you need to write the sequel here, just from a commercial perspective.
Obviously word of mouth has spread, and people are curious to know the science in there is still good. It's studies that started post World War II, where European scientists to escape the Holocaust era came over here, and they started asking questions: how could such intelligent people in Germany and Italy fall for people like Mussolini and Hitler?
Yeah.
And they got the answers. We've got 10 more years of it since I did it. And there's been more focus in the last 10 years on the social dominators. So I am thinking about doing a sequel to that. Because it's fascinating to watch. I don't know what's going to happen to Trump. I'm very interested in the people around him. People think Trump was a genius in finding these people and for the election. That isn't the way it happened, though. These people found Trump. It was just the reverse. They were attracted to him, not that he was able to run data analysis that found them and sent them mailers.
Well, he's always had a good instinct for what people seem to actually desire deep in their guts, whether they admit that or not. That is a fundamental consistent strain through his business career and his entertainment career and the political career, and sort of knowing how to play to people deep inside them. We're seeing how it plays out now and whether 2018 will give him more of a ratification than he has been getting so far politically.
Yeah, what we don't have are how much of the population are authoritarians.
Yeah.
The best guesstimate I was able to come up with when I wrote the book was around 25% to 30%. And that number seems to be pretty solid. That's about the core of Trump's support group.
All right. Well, I think we should maybe end it there with that stat. John Dean, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Well, that's a perspective that you won't get anywhere else, right? Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing and for Bridget Mulcahy joining again with an assist this week. Remember to subscribe and rate us and follow me on Twitter and like me on Facebook. And emails, send them to isaac@politico.com. And catch you next time on Off Message.